Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Echelon Data Centers is an international data center infrastructure developer providing large-scale assets to support the growing demand for data and computing resources, sustainably, responsibly and with due regard to the environment. It currently has 6 facilities in Ireland and the UK, either online or under development, with a combined potential for around 800 megawatts. Infrastructure that is built and managed sustainably and ethically, recognising the responsibilities the people and the partners they work with, the communities where they operate in, the society they are part of, and the planet we all share. Sitting in front of me is Niall Molloy, CEO and founder of Echelon Data Centres. He is also Managing Director of Aldgate Developments. A qualified chartered accountant with a strong background in banking and finance, Niall is highly experienced in commercial property development and has a proven track record of successfully delivering large-scale, complex projects on time and within budget while driving returns for investors. As CEO, Niall is responsible for strategic direction of Echelon Data Centres and takes an active role in all aspects of property selection, assessment, delivery and operations. Niall, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan. Delighted to be here.
Good. Right. Let's deal with the elephant in the room. We were talking just beforehand and it's always the same. Biggest criticism data centres is power usage, not sustainable, blah, 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 blah. Tell me why Echelon is different.
Well, there's two things. Echelon is different. We have invested very, very heavily in power systems to counter this. But I think when you look at the negativity towards data centres, it tends to break into two camps. One is the data centres are consuming too much of the power, not leaving enough power for everybody else, 20-odd percent or whatever the statistic happens to be in terms of average consumption. And the second one tends to be that it's challenging decarbonisation targets and you know, bad for the environment. To take those in turn, the power investment that we have to put into our schemes, we have to put in place large substations, we have to build our own backup systems. When we have connections from Airgrid, it is not commonly known that Airgrid are entitled to turn off our systems. It's what's called flexible demand. Airgrid are entitled to turn off our systems in a situation where the grid comes under any pressure. So it is mathematically impossible for a data centre with a new power connection to threaten the grid.
Because the switch is just flicked and you're done.
With appropriate notice. Yeah. The grid generally has surplus power. If ever that comes under pressure, Airgrid are entitled under the connection agreement to switch you off. So the idea that you could actually threaten the grid or that it could break it at peak times is simply not correct. In terms of general consumption, we do layer in our own backup systems. We layer in peaking plants. We layer in batteries. We layer in large power infrastructure that actually enhances the grid infrastructure and actually makes the grid stronger and creates greater surpluses of power. We also tie firmly into renewable power. And the idea is, if you take our Echelon's Arklow campus, and this is where we feel we are different, that is what is now termed by Airgrid the Exemplar project. It's where you have a large data centre which ties in to a large wind farm. And that data centre provides the business case for that wind farm to be delivered. We provide all the land infrastructure, the substations, the connections. We provide a backup peaking plant for the grid in case the grid ever runs into difficulties. And then we layer in, and every data centre has to show a route to zero carbon. That is part of the regulatory mandate from the CRU, that you have to show a route to zero carbon. That involves the layering in of batteries. We're doing a large battery BESS farm down in the Arklow area, that you layer in biogas. Again, there will be large biogas production there, and that you layer in renewable technologies alongside the wind to ensure that the carbon footprint of that data center is reduced to zero over a period of time. And that means that you can bring the regionalization job benefits on top of the renewable infrastructure that you're bringing, and that it actually becomes symbiotic with the local economy and with the national interest.
I think a lot of people don't realise is that one of the benefits really of data centres is they're always on. They are what we call a base load factor. They run at the same demand all the time, 24/7, 7 days a week. And actually, they are a benefit to the, almost as a counter to the natural cyclical, daily cyclical demand that everybody else operates. When we're fast asleep at night, they're still running at the same time, the same power that they're running at 2 in the afternoon.
If Ireland wants to decarbonise, we have to build large green infrastructure. To build that large green infrastructure, you need a business case. You either need the state subsidising it, or you need a user willing to take that power 24/7. And the issue that you refer to is the grid either has surplus or it has deficit. When the wind blows, it generally has a surplus. And very often there's what's called curtailment, where they have to pay people to switch off. Middle of the night, non-peak times. A data centre will generally provide a fairly steady base load. It provides an underlying business case, and it gets to consume that power and pay for that power at full value 24/7. That provides an underlying business case that avoids the state having to subsidise. But what happens then in practice is that there is surplus power off that. Mm-hmm. The renewable that gets developed is larger. If you take Arklow, it's anything up to a gigawatt. We're consuming maybe 200 to 300 megawatts even at peak when the data centre is fully operational and fully running. That means the grid is getting the benefit of a lot of that extra power. The underlying business case is paid for, and the infrastructure is paid for by the data centre. Mm. Furthermore, the data centre has to provide its own backup systems and its own peaking plants to enable the power, the grid and or the data centre to be powered in a scenario where those renewables aren't available, when the wind doesn't blow. So the whole system is better off for the presence of that data centre.
And then we were talking earlier on, before we started, about the whole, the benefits on a regional basis then of having those data centres spread across, because ultimately that's where power demand is lower, and that's probably where your ability to generate it renewably is probably better than sticking a load of windmills, wind farms in the middle of Dublin Bay where you might need it.
Yeah, I think you're referring there to the fact that the very, very large scale mega campuses that are starting to appear are generally related to artificial intelligence, AI, or to very, very large social media and cloud infrastructure. Those are more suitable for location in more regional areas. There is a necessity for certain quantums of data centres in more core metro areas, where it's sort of co-location services, where it's serving low latency, as they call it, businesses. But the larger sort of, the larger increased campuses and the large scale that is being seen at the moment is generally capable of being located in areas where, which are outside metro areas, where you're going to the source of renewables, where you're moving to more regional areas, and you're able to bring large investment, large numbers of jobs. You're able to tie in with that renewable infrastructure, and you're able to have large data center campuses sitting in these regional areas. And that is the future of this, both in the US and in Europe. You're seeing, you know, you're seeing governments across the world probably embracing these more, where you can bring them to regional areas. As you refer to, renewable power tends to be regionally based. It is very hard to do large-scale renewables in metro areas, in cities. They tend to be regional. The challenge grids have is how do they bring that power from those regional areas back to those metro and urban areas, which tend to be the consumers. That is a challenge. You're seeing it with Airgrid, but you're seeing it in grids right across the world. And, you know, there is a movement to try and get industrial development out of urban areas and into regional areas. That can be difficult for a lot of industries, but for large data centres, there's no reason why they can't. You've got a very, very large capital investment relative to, and the workforce tends to be more flexible, and you know, it's a number of high-paid jobs that get brought to those local areas.
Now, you mentioned the jobs one, because there is this this misconception, I think, out there that when it comes to data centres, you know, yes, there's a couple of jobs when you build them, but then there's only one lad sitting there and he flicks a switch at the start of the day, and then so he's the only job that comes out of these long term.
As the stereotype goes, it's the man and the dog.
Yeah.
The man is there to feed the dog, and the dog is there to keep the man away from the machines.
Yeah,
and it is a myth, and it's one that actually we do have to work to counter. There are very significant employments related to these large campuses. If you take our Clondalkin project, the Dub 10 project on the M50 there, that has anywhere between 1,000 and 1,500 construction jobs. Mm. But when people say it's construction, it is, there's a permanent construction cycle on these data centres. Remember, you've got large customers upgrading technology. There's a huge, there's billions of plant and machinery associated with these campuses. You have a huge servicing industry that goes with it. So you have a never-ending construction cycle within that. So the construction jobs a lot of those construction jobs are semi-permanent. You're going to find hundreds of people on a daily basis servicing these campuses. When you take the operational phase, we ourselves as the actual operator of the data center would probably have anywhere between 50 and 100 people on a campus, on a large campus. Power infrastructure, security, the actual underlying maintenance of the mechanical and electrical equipment. The customer who's running the racks and the IT will themselves have a lot of people running around, you know, servicing the computers and processing the actual facility for them. So each of those campuses should have hundreds of people working with them. You will have a permanent construction cycle associated with them. They're a very large industrial facility. It's like your Intel's in Leixlip. There has been essentially a permanent construction project going there for decades. Likewise with these large campuses, that's what you're going to see. And you then also have to look at the ancillary employment from the underlying tech companies, artificial intelligence processing, cloud, etc. That is their main business. They have huge employment related to the data that they're processing in these centres. That employment is largely Irish-centric at the moment, and that goes where the data centers are. And when you've seen places like Ashburn, Virginia, which is outside Washington in America, again, the ancillary employment and the ancillary office employment that goes with these data center campuses is very, very large to do with the underlying services that the companies have.
And then to wear the regional hat again, if you're putting them in and all those, the demand, are the jobs demand within the site also then has a natural knock-on effect to demand for services outside, be it coffee shops, all of that type of stuff that you just...
Well, if you take Arklow, which is a good example, it's an area that has struggled employment-wise for the last few decades since the fertiliser plant, which is where the data centre is being built, closed many years ago. There's a huge ancillary ecosystem. We're going to end up with, you know, circa 1,500 to 2,000 people building that campus. You're going to end up with a permanent several hundred people associated with the campus. That requires massive infrastructure in terms of retail, in terms of the servicers for that. You're going to have a lot of kit, and you're going to have a lot of people servicing that data center going forward. There's housing, there's ancillary retail services, there's, you know, education facilities, schools, etc. There's a massive quantum of new infrastructure that goes with that. It is a large development for the area, and there's a very large opportunity for that town to actually, you know, improve its general economy. It was seen in the past with large manufacturing facilities. These are the manufacturing facilities of the future, essentially, in these towns.
And again, going back to the electricity thing, this is a 24/7 job. Like, it's your workforce is not in 9 to 5, so you have a natural spread through the 24-hour cycle, seven days a week.
And these are also very high-paying jobs. It's worth pointing that out. The vast majority of people involved on sites are professionals. Very few people earning less than six-figure sums. So these are high-paying jobs that can actually massively benefit the local economy. And, you know, there is workers are attracted to work in more of these regional areas. There is better availability of housing. There is better availability of schools generally. And we just think there is a very good opportunity. And this is being embraced in various places around the world. There's a very good opportunity for regional government and for regulators to say that this is a way to promote regional development in countries where they have access to renewables, where you can solve the issue of how it links into the main cities.
Is there a chance we get left behind by the others if we don't start moving soon?
Yes, there is there's been a lot of commentary from the various tech companies expressing frustration at the pace of development in Ireland. I think the government has responded more in the last 12 months to this and has become more cognizant of it. You know, the large tech companies, these data centres are core to their business. We are seeing our business is now pan-European. We're very much engaging with other European countries, places like Spain and Italy. And you're seeing regional governments there being very proactive about trying to attract the digital economy to these regional areas. We've seen that in Spain, where they've passed legislation that basically allows where you locate at the source of renewables, you're entitled to an import connection, which allows the facility to be developed. It is important in Ireland that we keep subject to adherence to the regulations, and the regulatory environment has evolved policy that actually does allow these to be developed in regional areas. It is important that we allow these projects to progress. Arklow is the first one. It got its connection agreement last year. There is the opportunity for a number of other ones within Ireland where they adhere to the policy. Path to zero carbon, bringing the appropriate backup power, tying into the renewables. We agree that that's how this should be done. But where you do that, it is important that Ireland does allow those to progress, because otherwise there are long-term issues with the technology employment and with the whole AI revolution, which is a huge driver of employment going forward.
Was the move into data centres just a natural progression from other large-scale projects that you had done in the past?
I think our background, obviously, was in real estate and large office blocks in London and Dublin, with large construction teams and the ability to move large capital. So there was a natural synergy in terms of skill set. The opportunity to get into data centres happened, I suppose, by accident back in 2017. With the acquisition at short notice of what's now our Dub 10 campus, the old Aircom cabling facility there on the M50. The opportunity came through another developer, Mr. Michael MacDonald, who sadly passed away in recent years. It was opportunistic at the time. There was one of the large hyperscalers was looking for a lease at the time, was looking for capacity. The site had to be acquired and pushed forward at short notice. As it happened, the hyperscaler didn't take it in the end, and it became apparent to us that you needed to build a much more multidisciplinary management team, that you needed to have multiple sites, that you needed to be able to serve those customers in a much more holistic way than you would with traditional real estate. So with that, we built the team. We hired in Martin Murphy, who's the former CEO of Hewlett Packard Ireland, and built a full multidisciplinary management team, taking our construction skills and our capital management skills and pushing the business forward over a number of years. So I suppose it was opportunistic, but with that we saw the opportunity to build scale. We saw the restrictions in power, and we developed what we call our Power First strategy, where we invested very heavily in power systems, in infrastructure, in building substations, in getting those power stations consented and progressed to enable us to build these campuses.
Before we jump off the data centre track for a second, we've talked about the energy usage. The other one that people are talking about now as a big resource issue is water as a key resource to many of these. What's your view around that and the demand ultimately for it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously availability of water is something that is that has global issues. It is more of a problem in other countries than in Ireland. It is probably, in our view, not as big a problem as power is. There are ways to do water in terms of wells, in terms of recycling of water. I think the modern technology, if you look at things like liquid cooling, which is what is now used for the very large AI facilities, it involves its own coolants and its own liquids. Mm-hmm. So I think water, you have to obviously have access to water. You have to be willing to invest in water infrastructure to enable the centres to progress. But we don't see in traditional areas like Ireland or in areas which aren't suffering from major drought or water issues, we don't see that as being a particular constraint, provided it's carefully managed and provided you invest in the infrastructure.
Switching tack now more on about yourself, it strikes me, mentioned in the intro, that you're a qualified chartered accountant. It is amazing the amount of business owners and entrepreneurs that come through here that I talk to that have an accountancy qualification. What is it about accountants? Do you just not want to be auditors for your life, and you go, no thanks very much?
Well, it's interesting you should raise that. I would always term myself an accidental accountant.
Okay.
I was good at it in college. I joined Arthur Andersen, as it was, when I left after I did my BCom and MAC. Joined Arthur Andersen, qualified there for 3 years. It is a very good training. It's a very good grounding in project management, in financial management, and in sort of professionalism. It wasn't for me, and you know, I'm still very much in contact with all my Arthur Andersen colleagues. I work with some of them, or have done over the years. But it wasn't for me. I very much was of an entrepreneurial bent, wanted to get out of the straight sort of accounting practice and more into starting my own business and starting capital raising and financial management. But I would say that the training that it provides and the sort of background, qualification, credibility that it provides is still relevant to this day. It's still something I have on my CV. It's still something that's relevant when I go to raise ever-increasing amounts of money. Mm-hmm. So I certainly would recommend it for those who can hack it. Yeah. It does provide a very good lead into general business and into finance and capital raising.
And when you think about that role of an entrepreneur starting a business, no matter what end market they're ultimately doing, Do you think it's a mistake when an awful lot of entrepreneurs think they need to be experts in all the various different disciplines that you have to run a company, and kind of think that they can do everything on their own without actually going, you know what, there's better people to do this, I'm going to bring them in, I'm going to, you know, start a business as a team as opposed to start a business as a solo?
It's one of the major challenges we faced in our evolution. If you go to the background where we were building real estate, buying sites, getting planning consents, coming into the last downturn, it was very apparent during the downturn that we needed a much wider skill set, that we needed the ability to build successfully, that we needed the ability to deliver projects. And I think a lot of Irish developers at the time hadn't built that skill set properly around them. As we moved through that, so it was one of the key things that when we did the Aldgate developments phase of our lives, where we were building large scale office blocks in London, we had to build that multidisciplinary construction design development team around us. As we moved into the data centres, it became very, very apparent that the that a much larger team was needed. You needed people who were experts in delivery, who were experts in IT, who were experts in sort of telecoms and dealing with the tech customers. And, you know, as Echelon has evolved and raised large capital and sort of, you know, moved into both the international phase and the multi-billion euro phase, we've had a huge team building exercise, and it's been one of the main challenges for us as a sort of a founder management team is managing these disciplines which straddle design, power, operation, expertise. Investment is a huge investment team has come on board within it. You're in a permanent state of capital raising, you're in a permanent state of large delivery. You need proper people who have experience, who have industry experience, finance experience, construction experience, and you have to empower them and put in place the processes within the business to allow them to do their job. So, you know, we've evolved from being a small company probably to being what might be termed a medium-sized company. With that has come those challenges, and it is one of my core philosophies at this stage is you have to build a good team around you, you have to bring good people in, and you have to empower them.
And then as you move the business beyond the UK and Ireland, do you think though that skill set is easily transportable? You know, is it the core and the location really doesn't matter? There's a bit of local nuance, but the core has to be there.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I think you're seeing actually the data centre industry is, Ireland is at the core of the data centre industry. If you look at the very large contractors, and this goes back to the genesis of the data centre industry in Ireland, it was the very large multinationals, your Microsofts, Amazons, Facebooks, etc., building in the first instance their own large-scale data campuses. So the contractors, and there was a very big contracting and design industry that grew up around that. We have very, very strong, the leading data centre contractors in Europe, your Winthrops, Mercury's, there's a whole series of them, are all largely Irish-based. So Ireland has a very disproportionate amount of data centre skill, which is why it's so important to keep the industry pushing forward here. It's a huge driver of employment and export for Ireland. But yes, the skill set around, you know, there is a standardisation of these data centres across the world. Obviously, in Ireland, we get to use more what we call free air, where you're using sort of natural ventilation. Mm. You know, as you go to Central Europe, you'll start to use more air conditioning, you know, artificial cooling systems. But fundamentally, that's nuance. Mm. The skill set required, the relations with the customers and the trust the customers have in the Irish delivery system is quite high. And it's very transferable. And it's a big export. And there's been a number of articles written on this recently. It is a big source of export for Ireland. There are also a lot of manufacturing companies, the likes of E&I up in Derry and Donegal, the very large contracting entities. You know, these guys are spending most of their time putting people on planes to the rest of Europe and the world building these things. It's a huge international export.
And how do we, as a country, and how does the political system as a whole protect that industry that has grown for us? Well, you could say by accident, but not really. It is where we are. Yeah, I just say we've developed a great name across multiple disciplines within the data center area. It's not just they're great builders going at them. It's design, it's build, it's manufacture, it's everything that's come through there.
And it is important that we, I think the political system has had its challenges, primarily around some of the perception issues, as discussed earlier, on sort of power and decarbonisation on the one hand versus industrial development on the other. I think the regulatory system and the government entities themselves, the Department of Trade and the Department of Energy and Environment and Climate Change, have become more cognizant of this over the last, I would say, over the last 12 to 18 months, where, you know, it is important that we develop that regulatory framework. We, the CRU, have issued their policy, their large-scale user policy last year. You have to be in regional areas. You have to contribute power, as discussed earlier. It is important that we allow data centres to be developed to keep the skill set up and to avoid the full scale moving abroad of this.
So I think we're our own shop window, and if we don't put our best goods in the shop window, nobody's going to come looking for our services.
I think it's important that the industry engages with the issues that exist and show the solutions that can be brought to it, the example being the Arklow campus. That is positive for Ireland. It should allow more of this to be developed. That keeps the skill set up. It keeps a very strong domestic home market in development on this, which then allows those suppliers, those contractors, and you're seeing trends in the industry towards modularization, towards sort of more enhanced and faster forms of manufacturing that can enable this, the whole global system, to speed up. Ireland can be right at the forefront of that. It's not just the tech companies with their staff processing data and AI. It's also the delivery, the manufacturing, the kit providing, the modularization. Those are all things that Ireland is very, very well placed. It's already doing it, but it's very well placed to grow that over time. And I think we need a mixture of a domestic industry that serves that, plus the seeing this as a major exporter and treating it as an important industry to Ireland.
Yeah. There's an idea out there, you know, when you run a company, you know, the if you want people in your company to act like owners, they've got to be owners within the business, right? And when you look at the team that you've developed, is there that collective goal within Echelon as we look forward?
Yeah, and I think, look, our management style historically would always be very collegiate. You know, take a core group of people, be entrepreneurial, don't take no for an answer, get stuck in, what we call gunthering, to use an Irish expression. You know, manage your cash, collect carefully, keep going. And we would have a very loyal group of people who've been with us over the years. The challenge has now been to expand that and to keep that entrepreneurial culture going whilst embracing the growth and the inevitable processing and sort of more and structures that have to go with that. But within Echelon, we would, you know, we've been very successful at hiring in good people over the last 12 to 18 months, notwithstanding the pressures in the industry in terms of engineering skills. We are very careful to ensure that people coming in buy into the culture, buy into the expansionism, the entrepreneurialism, and making it clear that we are different from the rest of the industry. They have to be well rewarded as part of that, and obviously we have to be very careful that, you know, there are appropriate share schemes, there are appropriate participation schemes for people to really see that if they're willing to really dig in and allow this business to grow over time, that those opportunities are there for them to do well and to make a serious career for themselves.
There's always the, you know, with success, there's always the risk that you get distracted as a management team, that, right, you know, you get more money, you decide to branch out into stuff that you might look like good on paper, and then suddenly you go, bang, oh God, how did we end up in this cul-de-sac, right? So how as a management do you kind of not lose your focus or your intensity and your willingness to grow, but also not grow into cul-de-sacs?
I think that the answer to that is probably twofold. Number one, as discussed, you need to layer in the appropriate skill set. So if you take, for example, capital raising, a business like ours is investing billions in each of these campuses. That effectively leads you through large-scale debt and equity. That leads you to essentially a semi-permanent state of capital raising. Capital raising, large capital raising and large investment is, for most businesses, highly disruptive. It disrupts senior management time to a huge extent. We've had to embed teams within our business that actually do nothing but this all the time, so that the entire business and the entire senior management team are used to the process of that capital coming in, of that fundraising, and that you know, the information that has to be prepared, the processes that have to be shown, the ability to deal with investors, the ability to deal with funders, that needs to occur, and we need to have that as an entire function with it. It's as important as the manufacturing or the design part of the business. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to do that and not allow that disruption. So, you know, I think the team and getting that team in place is important. I also think that you have to ensure that entrepreneurial culture gets maintained as you go through, and that people are prepared to, you know, that people are prepared to, that you have a central vision, that you're following that vision, that you're clear what you're trying to do and what you're not trying to do. And we have to be very careful to set policy. Mm-hmm. We are trying to do large-scale data centres. We are trying to largely do them to serve the customer's needs. We're moving towards regional areas. We very much protect that power first strategy. What we are probably not doing is becoming a me-too operator doing sort of high-end colo facilities in core markets. And I think it's sort of important that you set a strategy out, bit like Ryanair in the old days, we are doing volume, we are going to regional areas, that you try to work out what you are and that you try to stick to that and avoid too many rabbit holes. In our business, it's quite streamlined. We understand what we're trying to do. We understand where our customers want to go, and we try to avoid branching into too many ancillary businesses. But you do have to understand power. You do have to understand renewables. We have tried to avoid getting into self-development of renewables, for example, because that is a huge huge branch that is a different
skill set. If somebody else's expertise and you don't need to have it.
I think it's important to understand what you do and what you don't do. We don't self-build. We use contractors. Mm-hmm. We don't, you know, develop our own renewables yet, certainly not unless forced to. So I think it's important to sort of, as the traditional expression goes, stick to the knitting, set your policy out fairly carefully and try and stick to it, and then layer in appropriate experts in the various functions within the business and ensure that those that evolution of capital can be managed without disrupting the business.
When it comes to innovation then within HLM, what are the major frontiers that are front of mind now? And, you know, are you the innovators, or are you just trying to react to the customers who are the innovators?
I think there's probably a bit of both. I think the big innovation in data centres in the last number of years is the move towards artificial intelligence, towards AI processing. What that involves is much larger amounts of power and much larger, denser servers, NVIDIA, who you've heard of, servers, GPU servers. That involves much larger power. It involves new cooling systems. Now, we're not in Echelon inventing new cooling systems. You know, the tech companies themselves and or other providers have been developing those systems, but we're having to implement those. And if you take our latest round of data centers in Ireland, will reflect AI technology, will reflect liquid cooling, it will reflect the ability to process those higher workloads going forward. So we are following, but we are implementing fairly quickly on the hoof technological changes that have occurred over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. I think then within our own business, delivery wise, we then have to look at ways in which, you know, everybody, there are supply chain issues, there are crunches of availability of mechanical and electrical equipment from large suppliers. There is problems in the contracting industry in terms of labour availability and the ability to do these things quickly. And we're having to look at how do we innovate with our suppliers to look at, for example, more modularisation, to look at different ways of construction, to try and overcome those bottlenecks and to have more off-site and less on-site construction. That type of innovation we're working with our suppliers offline to look at how we enhance that modularisation and how we improve timelines of and speed of delivery for customers. So we have very strong in-house design capability and we're enhancing that every day. We've enhanced the expertise that we would have on power systems, the expertise we would have on operations and refining those. So, you know, the building of the team and the expertise does lead to innovation. And again, there definitely is an evolution globally in how these things are delivered. The traditional ways of building are having to be looked at and a lot more modularization.
Yeah. And when it comes to staff, are you a develop from within or parachute from without?
I think if you look at the speed, we've ended up with a scenario where the team has gone from, you know, 10 to 20 people up to over 100 at the sort of senior management, core senior management level. Obviously, within the sites, there's probably 1,500, 2,000 people. You are hiring from the industry to build those teams. Obviously, we do try to make sure that people are cultural fit in terms of their approach to things and the entrepreneurialism. We have a lot of people have joined us who've worked with us in the past and who we would know. But yes, we are having to, with the level of expertise required, you are hiring from the industry. I think there is, thankfully, a very large expertise, both within the tech companies and within the large contractors and development companies. There is a very good pool of talent in Ireland that can actually staff these businesses. And we've been lucky with the availability of that.
Mm-hmm. What's the hardest part of the job as CEO?
I think that has evolved. You know, coming from a very entrepreneurial background, the the maturing of the business, the growing of teams, the necessity to have a lot more process in place. You're obviously dealing with a much larger sort of HR, putting in place performance systems, and allowing the delegation of that power down to the various teams to run it. That is required a change in management style from my side. It is an ongoing learning process. And I think the formalization of that, dealing with larger stakeholders, we obviously have a large partner in Starwood Capital as our partner, mm-hmm. having to deal with sort of regulators and external parties, there's a much more corporate process feel to it, which is a necessity. Mm-hmm. And it's evolving into that and making sure that that you can try to maintain the balance of culture and process. And that has taken some work amongst not just myself, but also the core founder team.
And when you think about the job of CEO, I would always say that you don't necessarily get better at the job as you go through it, but you get quicker at making the important decisions.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we've benefited from, and it was very important when we sat down and did the equity deal with Starwood earlier in the year, was to keep the decision making channels quick. It is an evolving industry. You need an ability to sit down with your partner and make quick decisions, and that has been really important. That is something that does set us aside from, for example, the tech companies or some of our larger competitors, and we've had to try and maintain that. Yes, you obviously have to be the subject of more formal papers when you want to look at a site or a project. There are formal investment papers that have to be produced. You have to go through the usual processes with partners, sign-offs, boards, etc. But I think it's been trying to strike a balance on that and make sure that the decision making chain is quick and reactionary, and that we can work well with our customers, which we've worked very, very hard on in recent years, and react to their needs quickly.
How important is it that your capital investors are aligned to you and the goals of the business?
It's absolutely critical. Right. You know, when you obviously as a business like this needs more and more capital, you need to have a process for raising it. You need to have a process for screening people who put up the money. So obviously from a debt point of view, look, you have a, you know, underlying leases, stock service agreements, you have delivery. So there's more of a well-trodden path on that. But when you look at equity and you look at investment, it is really important that those who put up the capital, which is why we've worked for so long with Starwood Capital. They've been working with us both on the real estate side and now on the data center side. We've taken over $2 billion in investment from them over the last 10 years. We've worked very well with them. We're their largest partner outside the US, as I understand it. And it's really important that you're trying to work with people that you know and have worked with, and that you
for continuity.
For continuity, and you know, for better or worse, you understand how each other work and think, that the decision making channels can be kept open, and you know that relationship has thankfully worked very well. But it is, to your question, it is very, very important. The choice of equity partner particularly is extremely important for businesses of this nature. You need, as a major management team with a major stake in the business, you need to be able to get on with your capital partners.
And then what about relationship with your board, and how do you manage things when things might not be going swimmingly?
Again, I mean, look, it's an ongoing dialogue. You know, the management, myself and the management team own circa 50% of the business. Starwood own the other 50%. There's obviously very, very strong daily, day-to-day engagement. So in our case, you try to not have it being board issue or surprise issue. Yeah. The issues get discussed between the protagonists on a day-to-day basis. That's how most successful companies and most successful boards operate. The board obviously is there to approve things, and we have to run through those processes. But it's a process of communication with your partners. It's as simple as that.
Who do you seek advice from?
Who do I seek advice from? I think there's a number of things. If you look at the likes of, say, Martin Murphy, the former CEO of Hewlett Packard, who's joined as chairman, I think he's able to bring, as we've gone through the corporatization process, that is something I've had to take learnings from, both from, you know, somebody like Martin, who's our chairman. I'm also involved in a personal capacity on a number of investment committees, the likes of Renatus Capital, I'm a director of. Mm-hmm. That would be a small private equity firm that has an awful lot of sort of high net worth individuals and private investors. And again, I would keep in very good contact with the Dublin business community as best I can. So yeah, I mean, you're taking advice from partners, the chairman, various people, you know, various people through my business networks. And it's an evolving process. I'm not the first person to have to take the entrepreneurial slant and sort of move towards a more formal CEO, more process-oriented business. And, you know, I'm continually learning and taking advice.
And what do you think is the most important personal characteristic for a CEO in a business, in that evolutionary business where you've gone from entrepreneur to a fully fledged business?
I think you need to be able to be decisive and to react on your feet. In my case, it's been important to try and create a collegiate atmosphere as best we can. It's all down to style. I like to create a collegiate atmosphere, try and bring people along. It is important to be decisive and to try and learn as you go. So I think, I think willingness to learn, willingness to change, but also keeping an eye on that culture and not allowing the culture of the firm to be changed too much. You do have to put your foot down sometimes on the cultural piece. So it's been a journey, certainly for me.
And how do you deal with setbacks?
Look, setbacks are a day-to-day feature of our business. You know, customers are taking a project, then at the 11th hour aren't. You know, capital raisings can go south at the 11th hour. It just happens. I've just got used to being resilient over a period of time. Keep sticking to it. Take advice. Do look where mistakes are made and correct. But fundamentally, just back yourself and keep going. That's generally what you have to do. And it's certainly something that served us well. There were a lot of people saying we wouldn't be able to get this business off the ground. We've had to, you know, take the Arklow project. You know, the idea of a regional campus was laughed at the start. We just had to stick to it, continue to invest, and continue to back ourselves, and follow the underlying thesis of lack of power and keep going. And that's that type of resilience. You know, we had to do that back in the day in the downturn on the real estate side, and that type of experience has served us well.
Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
I think fear of failure, I think particularly when, yes, it has. If you look at coming out of the downturn, NAMA effectively losing everything from a business perspective, you were forced to start again. We were forced to get on those planes at 6 a.m. to London to pull the Aldgate projects through. Failure was not an option. You had to drive those through. You had some very challenging markets there in terms of financing, in terms of leasing. Just had to drive through it. So, yeah. At that stage where you just have to succeed, I had young kids and multiple generations dependent on it. And yes, it's not fear of failure, it's just failure not being an option. And that resilience has stood to us. It's a different environment now where you have to be more balanced in decision making. And obviously the stakes are larger at this point. But certainly, you know, that resilience and being willing to just push through and not take no for an answer has been a core feature.
And was that the back to the wall moment, do you think, for you in your career?
Yeah, I think if you take the period post the last downturn, if you take the early to, you know, well, it was quite a long period stretching from 2009 through to 2016 when we managed to monetize Aldgate Tower. I mean, that was, if you look back now, that was anything up to 7 years. Some very, very difficult times. You were having to completely start again with the young family. Mm-hmm. You were having to get on planes. You were having to go through just, you know, and there was a whole series of of sort of stories about how we had to chance our arm and push through that. And yes, that was a very, very challenging time. And I think it's important for us to take the lessons out of that. The key thing I would say is you need to learn from the difficult times. You need to take those lessons. And what distinguishes those who are successful afterwards is those who took the lessons. There were a few. You needed to have a proper team. You needed to deliver competently. You couldn't just bull through and hope that the pure entrepreneurial thing would get you through. You had to be willing to learn from mistakes and change course. And, you know, when you look at the development industry there today, Irish developers back in the last downturn would have been good at raising debt and buying sites, but not potentially in the actual delivery piece. We had to work hard on trying to get that delivery piece working.
So have it end to end.
Working in London, competing with your British Lands and Land Securities and big traditional players who, you know, we were able to compete effectively with them because we were a lot more entrepreneurial, but we needed to deliver correctly. Those underlying large tenants will not tolerate anything that isn't proper from a quality point of view, that isn't delivered correctly. So you had to build that team correctly, and having a good team and keeping that culture is really, really important.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Do I obsess about the small things? Not particularly. We have enough large things in front of us on a daily basis. I do sometimes, you know, things like travel budgets, things like people wasting money. I'm known to annoy people, in fairness, around the office. Booking travel, people are people get annoyed when I start sticking my oar into that. Obsessing is probably not the right word. We obviously, as a much larger business, have had to get used to internal processes. As CEO, trying to keep yourself out of that day to day is a challenge, you know.
And therefore, do you hate losing or love winning?
I love winning. Both. I mean, look, anybody who's particularly driven, and I am a bad loser. As I always say, if you're a good loser, you become good at losing.
Losing, yeah. It happens more often.
So being a bad loser, whilst it can, it's not always the most endearing personality trait. Look, it is part and parcel of my makeup. So I would say both. We are focused. I would say we are very good at moving on to the next thing. In a scenario where something doesn't work, you've got to just draw a line under it and move on. You've got to be willing to push through, get on with the next thing. So whilst I don't like losing, and whilst we're very, very determined to stay the course on things, it's also important to evolve and to not spend too long chasing dead ends either. There's a balance there, you know.
How do you feel about what you've already done in the company?
I think we're very proud of what we've already done. It took a lot of effort, and it was extremely challenging, and we're facing a very difficult industry. So we would be very, you know, as a founder team and as a sort of a senior management team, we'd be very proud of what we've achieved. There are big challenges in the industry ahead. You know, the regulatory thing is very tricky for data centers going forward. You do have a very big wave of demand in AI, but you have to watch that and watch the behavior of the customers and keep those customers with you. You're getting into very, very large capital and very, very large staffing. That presents challenges to the next phase. So we're very proud of where we're at. We're very, very excited about the next phase of development. And we're watching those trends as we go through to see what the most sensible way through them is.
Mm-hmm. It always makes me laugh when I hear people ranting about data centres and new data centres and all this type of thing. They're the very same ones that don't want to get rid of all their TikTok videos off their phone.
Well, I always say there's a certain irony in an online poll, an online poll to get rid of data centres, or an online campaign. Yeah, I mean, look, it is a source of frustration. A lot of the commentary that goes with this, and the industry, because it's been quite secretive traditionally, has not defended itself. There are a number of robust defences to this in terms of the generation of power, in terms of the actual pulling these things forward and making people aware of how central to employment this actually is.
So does the industry just need to put that data out there and get that data out there in a coherent manner?
I think it is important that we do try to counter it where it comes up, because I think when you look at the breaking the grid, that's just mathematically incorrect. The issue of the decarbonisation, like, these things enhance decarbonisation, the employment, there is strong employment. That is like straight out myth busting. It is important for the industry to do that because it's relatively technical. Sometimes it's hard to translate it into quick sound bites. It's much easier for a negative sound bite to appear than a positive one, and it's an ongoing battle. And I think the industry, if you take the data centre industry as a whole, it does need to get better at defending itself and pushing its own interests. You also have diverging camps within that industry in terms of sort of colo and metro areas versus regional. I think it's very hard to justify huge development in urban areas over time until those grids are massively improved, you know.
What advice would you give to young people?
I think, what advice would I give? It's sort of drawn from the lessons, I suppose. You know, the resilience thing that I said before. You know, sticking at it, not taking no for an answer, taking advice and assessing if you're right or wrong, but fundamentally sticking with it. Building the team around you is crucial for you don't know everything. You have to build that team around you, and you have to make sure that you take those appropriate skill sets. I think I was listening to a podcast there involving Charlie Munger about a year ago, Warren Buffett's partner, and again, he was asked, you know, what are your sort of lessons? And he was, well, you know, work hard, be smart, which is fairly predictable stuff. But he had two other ones that I thought were that sort of stuck with me. One was you have to have luck. In any entrepreneurial entity, you do have to have luck. They caught a huge bull market. In our case, you know, we obviously saw that data centers made sense, but we didn't see how big the wave was going to be. You have to have luck. And then the fourth one was even more interesting, is when you find that streak of luck, you must back yourself fully to pursue it. And the difference between people who succeed and those who don't is taking the opportunities. If you see that streak of luck, go for it, do it. And it's really, really important that you back yourself wholeheartedly to do that and to actually push through. And I think that's that's the difference between success and failure. And then a couple of other ones, you know, make sure you enjoy it and have some crack. It is, if you're going to be running an entrepreneurial business for a number of years, it's a long journey. You can't do something you hate. You have to work with people you get on with. We still, to this day, one of the core hiring criteria is, could I have a pint with this person? Yes. Can I get on with them? It's really, really important. You have to have a degree of crack, and you have to enjoy the journey itself rather than
the destination.
Yeah. It is, you are, if you're involved in entrepreneurial businesses, you are building something over time. It's huge. It requires huge dedication. You have to enjoy it, and you have to get on with people, and you have to have crack along the way.
On that point then, what gets more credit for your success, luck or hard work, you think?
I think, you know, what is it, the more I practice, the luckier I get, as the stereotype goes. I think you need both. Look, you need to work hard, you need to stick with it, you need to be resilient, you need to not take no for an answer. That's hard work. Is it comes in various forms. It's not just processing. Yeah. It's actually being clever
mindset.
About how you do it, and mindset. And then fundamentally, you need to look is a sort of, you do need some luck, but you need to watch out for the luck as well. You need to watch those trends, find businesses, try and pursue businesses that have some scale behind them. That's certainly my view. You know, a lot of for companies, for entrepreneurial or family-owned companies where they have various business lines and new things they can get into, you have to see something might be profitable, but does it have the scale? Yeah. Does it have an ability to actually justify the time? Yeah. One of the sayings I have is people think that money is the limiting factor. It's not. Time is the limiting factor. If you've all the time in the world, you can make all the money in the world, but you don't. So how do you optimize that? I think it's really important that you focus on businesses that can have some scale, that can work. And if they don't have that scale, even if they are micro and can succeed, you need to cut them because you mightn't have the time to pursue them. So it's not so much straight out. You do need to get lucky, and you need to catch waves of uplifts, and the big success stories in business do tend to have caught some sort of wave in terms of trends or demand. But you need to be watching for those opportunities, you need to be taking them when they appear, and you need to take those gambles. And very often that involves backing it with your whole net worth, you know, running the risk that if it doesn't work, you're going to have to start again. And that's, you know, for a lot of people that doesn't work for them. You know?
Right, we've come to the last question. I open it up and we'll see what we've got.
Sense of trepidation.
Well, you and me both. All right. This will be an interesting one, Ryan. Describe the one pivotal moment in your life, not just career, where things could have gone much differently, and what made you choose the path you took.
Okay. I think you'd have to go back to the end of the I'll call it the end of the downturn or the beginning of the recovery, whichever way you like to look at it, back the sort of 2010 2011 period. We had a situation where we would have come through, you know, through the 2000s effectively, or end up in NAMA, things are gone bust, you've lost all personal wealth, you're left with a situation where I had about three generations dependent on me. What do you go back to being more traditional at that point, or do you double down and go again? And in my case, we doubled down, went to London, got on the plane, started doing what we were doing. I think that was a major, you know, drive our own luck out of it, drive that business forward, you know, keep relations going and just push on. I think that was a major pivotal moment at that stage. The other alternative was to go more conservative, to go back to take a more traditional job and to sort of push on with a more traditional outlook on things, and there were opportunities to do that. And I think at that time I would have made the decision to push on hard and to do, you know, you could say it was by, we had no choice, but I did at that stage. And I think that was probably, if I take a decision, you know, that was the point at which there was a proper do we or don't we?
Proper fork in the road.
Yeah, after that, going to real estate and then getting into data centers, it's obviously been the huge uplift and it's enabled me to go again, but it was probably more natural evolution. There probably wasn't, if I'm honest, the degree of straight out risk and decision making that in getting into that. I think the pivotal moment was that, you know.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Niall Molloy. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.